Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us on the path to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. We have another purpose too, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Speaking about overwhelming, take our economic system, please. According to a report on the economic well-being of U.S. households in 2018, 40% of Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck and can't cover a $400 emergency expense, not to mention those living from paycheck to paycheck without the actual paycheck. Well, so much for trickle-down economics, which the Swami explains as, well, the wealth is all on top, with some of it trickling down to those at the bottom, and that is why they call the people at the bottom peons, right? Well, if you get pissed on, you're going to get pissed off, and that might explain why swing voters abandoned a neoliberal Democratic Party in 2016 for the wild card, unpredictable Donald Trump. Well, today's interview is about the exact opposite of trickle down. I called it bubble up, where a new economic plan will send financial well-being bubbling up from the bottom and will benefit everyone from the super poor to the super rich. So are you ready to stretch your imagination? You sure? Okay. Imagine, as if by magic, there's no more income tax. No more sales tax, no more property tax. And then imagine we have a new way to pay for everything the government currently spends money on, plus free health care for all, Social Security that is secure forever, and a guaranteed income of about $24,000 a year for every adult American. Oh, and then also imagine, on top of that, we pay off the national debt. Our guest this week, Scott Smith, is an economic visionary with feet-on-the-ground experience, and he has a plan to do just that. He calls his proposed legislation the Financial Freedom Act, that by taxing the $5 quadrillion in financial transactions that take place every year, instead of the mere $16 trillion in income, we can finance the world of our dreams. Over the past several generations, our economy has shifted from the quote-unquote material economy, which is the part of the economy that is about making things, to the, quote, monetary economy, the part of the economy that is about making money. A few years ago, somebody asked the Swami, how do we improve the overall economy? And Swami answered, the way we improve the overall economy is overalls. When more people wore overalls to work, the overall economy was better. Well, here's why. Because we've had factories closing, production jobs going offshore, an entirely new industry has now become the way to create wealth. That is the finance industry. Well, a tax system that was created more than a century ago reflects a time when most of the money in the economy was made by through making things, where that has changed, where most of the money is made by making money rather than producing value. So the financial economy has grown the world of interest and speculation and mergers and acquisitions. That is expanded, while those who produce and provide income are forced to bear the burden. So I want to say something about Scott, and then we'll just get right to the interview. Scott was an early pioneer in structured finance, launching the first mixed property commercial mortgage conduit and securing a billion-dollar line of credit from Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. We'll talk about that. He also helped structure financing for President Nelson Mandela's redevelopment program for affordable housing in South Africa. On a totally different track, he is founder and former publisher of Kids Magazine, that's Kids with a Z, which invited young readers to submit their own content. Publication grew from a local magazine to an international media channel with a circulation that spanned 30 nations. So what an amazing project that was. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but mostly we're going to talk about this new financial freedom plan. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, let's jump right in. As I said in the intro, your idea for Financial Freedom Act is one of the most promising, I think, and workable programs that will up-level the quality of life for all Americans and empower a truly regenerative economy. So why don't you just start by outlining the key ideas and provisions?
Okay. Well, I think I was in a unique position because I found that equal numbers of my friends were conservatives and liberals. I lived in Boulder, Colorado, and I worked on Wall Street. And I really saw that the core values of what both groups were talking about were fine. It's just that we felt we were living in this zero-sum game where if you were to help out the poor, it was going to be at the expense of the rich. And if you were to balance the budget, it was going to require austerity. And we were in the quandary, really. And so people were picking sides based upon which core value they thought was more important. Because the truth is, if you were to sit down with a liberal, no matter how left-wing they might be, and you say, you think all of this national debt is a good thing? Do you think this deficit is good? I mean, it doesn't seem good to me. And if you were to sit down with a conservative, you know, let's say a Christian white right-winger and say, did Christ teach compassion for the poor? They wouldn't object to that. It's just that we felt we were dealing with a situation that had pitted in us against them. So that was kind of the view that I was taking from the beginning. And so I asked myself a really poignant question, which is, how much does it cost to solve all of these problems? So in essence, we pay for it one way or another. You know, we borrow the money that we spend in the government that we don't tax. And so that money's coming out of the system one way or another. Healthcare is getting paid for, whether it's an insurance company or out of pocket or through a government program, it's getting paid for. And so I said, what is the total cost of healthcare for everyone? What's the total cost of higher education? What would be the total cost to in poverty? You look at the broken social security system. Well, what would be the total cost of retirement for everyone? Not just the ones who pay in. What's the total cost there? What's the total cost in that deficit? What's the total cost to get rid of the national debt over some reasonable period of time? Let's just find out what that cost is. And then we see, let's say, the magnitude of the problem. Is there a way to handle this, or are we completely screwed? So in the course of my working through this, there were a lot of times when I thought, yeah, we're in deep trouble here. I think we're going right into a brick wall at 9 miles an hour. There is no solution. You know, I felt that way more often than not. But coming up with the total cost, again, looking at it from how efficiently can you execute this, not just saying let's let medical costs go through the roof. What's reasonable comparing it to what other countries spend and how they're doing? And the total cost, if you're being as careful as you can, is about $10 trillion per year, $10 trillion a year. Wow. So that was a point in time when I felt like we're going into a brick wall at 90 miles an hour because our federal spending right now is $4 trillion, and every state and local government agency, if you add them together, that's another $1 trillion. So we're at a level of $5 trillion spending, and we have the need for 10. Our income is only $16 trillion, as you mentioned in your opener. So, you know, tax rates of, say, 75%, 70%, that's not going to be attractive. That's across the board, even for the poor, you know. And so it was, it seemed challenging. But I had a couple of data points that gave me some hope. One data point was, if you're looking at what our government, what our nation buys today, you know, what our spending is today, and you didn't know our financial system, if you were observing it, from a physical location, watching everything happening, and you weren't aware of the cash flow, you would say, well, these people, they have the human and natural resources and the know-how to complete every project they make. So they can afford it. We can afford the aircraft carriers we build, the schools we build, and the highways we build. Otherwise, we'd run out of resources, and we're not running out of resources. It's just in how we're paying it. So I thought it's a somewhat artificial construct that we're dealing with the problem anyway. That was a hopeful point, you know. Another hopeful point was an odd dinner that I went to out on Wall Street. It was with a couple of traders, and they had just partnered with these guys and pulled down a series of trades. This is not on the New York Stock Exchange. That's where people make a mistake. It's not the New York Stock Exchange that you tax. They pulled down these trades that totaled more than the gross domestic product of the entire world in 1 week, a handful of guys. And I was stunned. You know, I started thinking just how much money changes hands each year in our economy. We might be taxing the wrong thing. And so that was a data point. But back in the 90s when that happened, the data of the total payments out there wasn't available. We didn't track that. So a point in time came when the Federal Reserve began working with the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. In fact, all the central banks of major countries began working together with the BIS, and they began establishing protocols for payment technology. And part of that was beginning to assess how many treasuries are sold each year. What is the total amount of money that an entity or an individual gets in their hospital hands each year from a payment? Real hard money changing hands. And that data is now available. We've been getting pretty good at establishing that over the last 5 to 10 years. That's where your $5 quadrillion figure comes from. 5,000 trillion. That's over 300 times as much money as we earn in income. That tied into a third data point that kind of gave me the intuition that there's another way to do this. And that is data that came in that since the 1970s, income has remained flat. So if income has remained flat and everything else has grown, income is becoming a smaller percentage of the economy, and you want to attack. You want to tax as broad of a base as you can. And that's what a payments tax is. The lowest tax you could ever have is to just take a small fee out of every time money changes hands, every time there's a payment bag. That's the lowest tax rate you could have in theory. And that's the concept behind the payments tax, is that the settlement system itself, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's PayPal, whether it's the Federal Reserve, the DTCC, all sorts of other acronyms that nobody's even heard of that are behind the entire system where this money shifts hands, if in fact it was the requirement of the settling agent to pull that 0.2% out of the economy each time and delete it, not send it anywhere, then you could have the Federal Reserve on the other side of the equation creating out of thin air, as they do, as they always have done, the money that you need at the government's level, and it would be disappearing through the settlement system at the same route. Now, why you would do that is you don't want to collect the money penny at a time and have to route it into reserve accounts and back to the treasury. You could do that. I mean, it would work just the same way, except it would be 10 to 20 times the overhead to do it that way, and compliance would be a lot harder. This is the simplest way.
So you're saying that the money would be taken out, simply deleted from our money supply, and then be recreated as it's issued by the Federal Reserve. So what an interesting idea.
But it's what you heard of quantitative easing, right? QE1 and QE2.
Yeah.
The Fed generated roughly $85 billion a month. It's almost $1 trillion a year. They created that on their balance sheet, and then they went out and bought bonds with it primarily. They bought assets with it. That's the job of the Federal Reserve, to create money. That's what fractional reserve lending is. Commercial banks are allowed to lend out. It depends on the reserve level at the time, but let's say they have $1 million in deposits. They can lend out $5 million. Where do the other four come from? Fractional reserve lending is a mandate that allows the commercial bank to literally create the money. And it goes out into the economy, and that has served us well. That works. Man created money, whether it's gold, Bitcoin, or dollars, is by the consensus of people, and the value of that money ties to the fundamental health of the material economy underneath, the integrity of the agreements, and the integrity of the money supply. We invent the fact that gold is money as much as we might invent coin to be money or dollars to be money. So that's not a new concept.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a very short break now, and as you get a chance to digest this very interesting idea, we'll get more into the details with our guest, Scott Smith, and we're talking about the Financial Freedom Act. This is Steve Behrman, and we're on Wiki Politiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please, help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, Steve Behrman, we're back with our guest on WikiPolitiki, Scott Smith. We're talking about the Financial Freedom Act, and we're just trying to wrap our heads around this concept that instead of the income tax and these other taxes that have been taxing us for so long, if we simply taxed payments, that every time a payment was made, a very small percentage would be taken out of the economy and then put back in through the Federal Reserve, then we could actually essentially heal our current financial situation and make things available for other for all of the things that we really need. So why don't you continue outlining this plan, Scott, how would we use this how much would we get from this $5 quadrillion if we taxed that?
If we did that at 0.2%, we would have $10 trillion in revenue each year. And obviously $1 trillion of that would have to go to state and local governments, and that would replace sales taxes and property taxes. Another $4 trillion of that would go to pay for the current budget and cover the deficit. So we'd no longer have the deficit, which would leave $5 trillion that could be spent in the form of paying every adult citizen $24,000 a year in basic income. And then when they hit 70, that would go to $30,000 a year. So what you've done there is you've eliminated the need for welfare, and you've also eliminated the Social Security Administration with this one simple to administrate basic income plan. So it's less overhead, far less overhead, less red tape, no red tape. But you've got this basic income coming into the population. Now, you would need to marry that idea with an earned income credit because you still need people working. And so the earned income credit that marries with basic income would be from $0 to $10,000 in income. You get a job at minimum wage, you'd have a 50% credit. So if you've earned $10,000, you're going to actually receive an additional $5 on top of your basic income. So combination of that gets people working, and it also provides a stimulus into the economy. You would also have free health care. We call it the American Medical Plan, though, because it addresses the need for the free market to enter back into how health care is done. We found the American Medical Plan to be very popular with conservatives and with liberals. And then a certain college plan we call the Challenge Program, which, again, the way it's administered, it keeps the cost of college down. That's our challenge today. The cost of college is going up. Those programs together would provide sufficient stimulus to really stoke this production engine that we've created over the years. That it answers businesses' number one problem, which is lack of customers. We've all grown up in a generation in which we think it's always been the case that businesses are fighting over market share. If you go to GM and you say, why don't you do produce twice as many cars and make twice as much. Their response to that is, well, that's not a problem to produce that many more, but no one will buy them. That is a rarity in the history of man. Most of the history of man, we've struggled from a business perspective to provide enough to meet the demand. Today, supply is not the problem. It's demand. And so basic income plus an earned income credit, getting rid of income taxes and property taxes, allows enough capital in the pockets of the consumer that we can turn on the spigot from the factories that are out there and solve business's number one problem. You, it's indicative. Think of it. Facebook, Google, you know, some of the largest companies out there, they don't produce a thing. What they are is traffic cops for the consumer. Amazon's the same thing. The producers are so desperate for consumers that the largest companies in the world are the ones that just route consumers. That just shows you
that really is interesting. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
That's how starved we are for businesses. So, you know, I'm asked a lot, well, wait a minute, the basic income and, you know, all this, is this going to be inflationary? And it's, if you have demand exceeding supply, yeah, of course it's inflationary. But at this point in time, to ask the producers to produce maybe 20 to 30% more, I mean, they could actually produce 50 to 100% more. As long as you have a competitive environment for selling into the consumer, you're not going to have inflation. Inflation is coming from our economic system of borrowing. It's the effect of interest on our economy. It's not because demand is growing. It's not. You know, we can easily meet the demand. So this wouldn't be inflationary.
So along with that, of course, we're also talking about modifying the roles of the banks. As you read deeper into your paper, how would the bank's role be modified in relation to charging interest?
So now you're going deep into the plan, aren't you?
I couldn't help it. It was fascinating.
Usually in a radio interview, we just go through the part I've gone through. But I'll be honest. The part that I think is most significant is what I call Banking 2.0. And that goes hand in hand with the tax changes and the benefits. Banking 2.0 really comes from my own personal experience in banking. I got involved in commercial real estate lending. So this is lending money, putting mortgages on shopping centers, offices, multifamily, you know, apartment buildings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I got involved in that in the late 80s. And so three financial crises ago, we had a crisis called the savings and loan crisis. You know, so you get older in life.
I remember that one. History, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you remember it too. I didn't have a lot of
the good old days.
Then, no?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in that crisis, back then, for those who remember it, we were paying double-digit mortgage rates. We're paying 10 to 12% on a mortgage. And the crisis hit, and things were in danger of getting worse. You had pundits on Wall Street saying Treasury bonds were going to hit, we're going to exceed 20% on the interest rates. And so I was involved in mortgages, and I could see there was a significant challenge, and it all came to cost of funds. You had a banking industry that was starved for deposits, and they were paying high interest rates for the deposits, and that translated into high mortgage rates. And yet, on Wall Street, there were bond offerings, rated bond offerings, you know, like a double A back then was 7%. Now it's much lower than that. And I said, it's rather simple. Where do you get your money from? You ought to go after the cheaper money where the cost of funds are lower. And that was the spirit that I went to DLJ, got the rating agencies involved, and we did the very first of the conduit financings where we were accessing capital through the capital markets and not through depository. That caught on. Over 17 trillion of those mortgages were done. That caught on, and that supercharged the 90s, and it brought interest rates down for housing and for commercial real estate under 5%. Now, we learned a really valuable lesson, and this lesson applies to everything I'm proposing today. There is no free-for-all out there. There's, you know, there's no panacea that you can't screw up. The credit default swap, when that entered into the mortgage-backed securities, that was the end of the 90s. So we used those MBSs very successfully through the 90s, so successfully that if you were to talk to a lot of people on Wall Street or in banking, they were saying they were, and they used this word back then, they were bulletproof. These things are bulletproof. In other words, you can't do a bad pull, you can't. And I said, they're not bulletproof. They require very good underwriting. We just have a very good cost of funds, and you've got a cash reserve with each pool. As soon as you pull the plug on that with the credit default swaps, the writing was on the wall that we could get sloppy and we could have a crash, which we did have in 2007, 2008. But banking 2.0 recognized that, wait a minute, cost of funds, that's critical. And you look at the lending community today, you have three parts. You have one is the originator. I was an originator through the 90s. If interest rates were 0%, I would have loved that. I would have originated a lot more mortgages. You have the servicer. They're the ones that collect the monthly check. They generally get around 0.2% a year. So there's a cost for a mortgage that's around 0.2% in order to have a servicing environment. You pay your origination at origination. You could just as easily go to the Federal Reserve for home loans and say, provide the capital for the home loans and don't charge any interest rate on it. And you have a much healthier real estate market for that. Now you're going to change the underwriting standards so that instead of 33% of somebody's income, it's only 16%. You've got to tighten that up. Otherwise, you won't get any benefit. Home value will double. But as long as you change those underwriting parameters, it's going to be, it just costs Americans half as much to buy a home as they used to. And that's what technology is all about. You get twice the computer you do today than you did 5 years ago for the same amount. There's absolutely no reason not to apply financial technologies and bring the cost of buying a home in half. That's what Banking 2.0 establishes. So there's a lot more to it than that. But that's just one little tweak that we could easily do that would make a lot of sense.
Well, you know, all of this really talks about, essentially releasing people from the bondage, not just of having to pay the IRS, but having to work for the IRS. So what's happening is that it's very good that there is this this guaranteed income notion, because if this goes through, and I'm going to do everything I can to work for it, all of these people who have jobs and positions and GS this and GS that, they're going to be, I'm sorry, we're done with you. And so all of these institutions in the financial industrial complex, if you will, how do you deal with the pushback from those who are already very, very, very well invested in things the way they are?
That's a real good question. And I believe this will happen. It's not going to happen tomorrow because it's just not out there. But it has traction, and it will happen fast when it starts to get out there. And I actually was sitting on a plane next to a woman who is a senior VP in one of the four big accounting firms. And, you know, she looked at it and she said, you know, a large swath of our business will go away if this comes into being. And she said, but I'd vote for it because what it's going to do for our economy and the other doors it's going to open. You know, it's just churning jobs. It's not like the jobs are going to dry up. We're going to have more jobs. It's the way to go. It's the future. And I think the same thing with respect to people who work for the IRS. If you have basic income, you're going to have a cadre of employees within the government that are going to have to administer that. Admittedly, it's a much smaller group of people than the IRS currently is. But there's a new home for a lot of those workers. And here's the odd part. Since we're already paying their salaries under a highly burdensome income tax system, if we switch to a payments tax, we can afford to give them a 24-month, runway to switch to new jobs. I mean, we actually could afford that. under this new system. So you can design a gentle transition system. It's all about change management. And you build the proper, and change management is actually a key element in the Financial Freedom Act. All of those issues are addressed.
Wow. You know, this is, you know, again, I would see that most people on in looking at this, again, you used the word bulletproof. Everybody is going to go, well, what's, yeah, where's the catch? What's the flaw? And I think that you hit it on the head when you said that this is really a massive, massive shift in efficiency from doing things that really don't actually have to be done, liberating people from these things that don't really need to be done and are only done in a system, you know, based on the obsolete structures that we have right now.
It's a disruptive technology. Yeah, it's no different than other disruptive technologies. It's like people say, well, who's the loser? It's like when you have a properly designed disruptive technology, you don't have a loser. You might have some, I mean, let's take a, you know, you're riding horses and now you're going to go to cars. And so you might say, well, the guy who used to make buggies for horses, he's the loser. No, he's working at Ford and he's making three times the money, you know. You develop the aircraft. It's like, who was the loser when we had flight? No one, you know. Who was the loser when we had the internet? No, we can just instantly communicate around the world now at no cost, you know. You do not have to have net losers when you have a disruptive technology. And so this entire bill was designed with that in mind. It's like, how do you have a net gain out there for everyone? Because truly, as the material economy we all live and are used to has become more technical and matured and gotten better and better, we're all net gainers. If you were to take a snapshot of people today and compare it to a snapshot 12,000 years ago of people eking by in caves, you'd say everybody's a little better off. Well, that's the whole point. You know, you want to design economic policies in which everybody is better off.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and in the final section of WikiPolitiki, we're going to talk more about how this can come about. I'm Steve Behrman. We're talking with Scott Smith, and we're talking about the Financial Freedom Act. We'll be back after these messages.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the WikiPolitiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Well, this is Steve Behrman. I'm back with our guest on WikiPolitiki, Scott Smith. We're talking about what I think is really a world-changing concept, the Financial Freedom Act, the Economic Freedom Act. We call it Financial Freedom Act. I'm sorry. I misnamed it. What I'm noticing, of course, in the world right now, one of the things that's really huge is that we are coming to the limits of using some of the things we've been extracting from the earth. And we are also coming to the limits, as I'm coming to understand through my study of microbiome and genetically modified organisms, glyphosates, et cetera, that we have a very dangerous situation with our soil and so on. And we need to shift not just from an economy that is, you know, based on 100 years ago, but we also need to switch to a restorative economy rather than a chiefly extractive economy. So assuming, you know, that this is your agenda as well, how does the Financial Freedom Act empower these new kinds of enterprises?
So that takes us right back to banking 2.0 again. And it is through banking 2.0. If you look at, let's look strategically at the U.S., United States position in a growing global economy. We're in a situation which is increasingly competitive and in which the challenges are not just one nation versus another, but it's also how do you support the population that we have and how do you stay friends with the earth? How do you do it in a way that does not jeopardize future generations? And the solutions to that really have always come through technology. And I don't mean it in a harsh sort of way. You know, I think the heart is an important thing. I think values are important things. But if you look at, if you had 8 billion hunter-gatherers on the planet, you'd strip the planet bare. It would last for a few weeks, you know, and people would be starving. And so all the situations that you're describing, you know, about the soil, about the environment, are all technological issues. And in large measure, a lot of the solutions already exist in terms of energy and alternatives. But though any solution does exist, it will give way to another solution down the road. So when you look at how does this technology come about, whether it's to live more sustainably, whether it's to compete against China, it's all coming from startups. It's all coming from innovation. It's all coming from the minds of the entrepreneurs. And the irony about today's economy is that if you look at access to capital, the easiest, cheapest access to capital is from Fortune 500 companies on the New York Stock Exchange. Then you start dropping down from there, corporate finance, and then finally you get to private equity, and then you get to venture capital. As you go down that ladder, that capital is more and more expensive. It is harder to come by. And so from venture capital, which you have to get into the tank with the sharks, right? That's, you don't
Absolutely.
Want that to be that way.
Yeah.
There's this gap called seed money. And it's, you know, where does the average guy go when he's got a new idea? You go around, you try to meet somebody wealthy. You go to Angel Fest. It's the hardest money to raise. And yet those companies, those startup companies are the most important companies for the future of our nation and of the world. And so the solutions the things that you're talking about, they've got to come from individual creative minds, and they've got to be financed to be able to do that. So under banking 2.0, again, when you look at you don't need the money to come from the depository base. The money ought to come directly out of the Federal Reserve. And deposits, when you go to J.P. Morgan to deposit your money, that ought to go into the Federal Reserve. That's the only certain way that you know your money is going to come back. And so the business of banking is no longer tied to depository bases. The business of banking is tied to who's a qualified borrower, who's a qualified equity investor. You know, it's that actuarial data. Who needs the money? Who deserves the money? Who's going to be able to pay it back? What is a good startup? That data, that type of question, we have years of actuarial data to back that up. We understand that. And that ought to be the job of the entities that stand in front of the Federal Reserve that put that money out. The lenders, the VCs, PEs, all of that. The source of the capital ought to be the central bank. Where your money is deposited ought to be the central bank. And then that money coming out comes out at a lower cost of funds, whether it's a home loan or whether it's a startup. You know, do you have to give up 80% of your startup, you know, versus can you give up 20% of your startup because the capital costs less? That makes the economy more efficient. And so the solution to environmental problems, the solutions to any of these types of problems, they really come from the entrepreneurial world. And the entrepreneurial world accesses its capital through through banking 2.0. That's why I look at banking 2.0 and say that's even a more powerful idea than getting rid of income tax and paying basic income. Because that is our future.
Exactly. Yeah. And finally, the Federal Reserve actually becomes a Federal Reserve instead of a privately owned institution.
Right. Right. A central bank.
Where our money, it's our money, right? Exactly.
It's our bank. It's our money. We invented it. The purpose of money is to serve people. There's actually, let me go into the biblical scriptures for a moment and point to two interesting data points there. If you look in the scriptures, you see that Christ consistently was getting in trouble from the Pharisees because he would perform a miracle on the Sabbath. And finally, Christ looks at the Pharisees and says, look, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You could say the same thing for money. We invented money for our purposes, to serve our purposes, not to serve money's purposes. We invented money. We invented the financial system. We ought to engineer the financial system so that it serves the purposes, the well-being of the people. That's what Banking 2.0 is about. And that's where a payments tax comes from, too. You're looking at financial engineering that serves the purposes of the people.
Wow.
Your second data point, going back to the scriptures, interest was banned. Interest was banned. The Judeo-Christian, interest is banned. Hinduism, interest was banned. Buddhism, interest is banned. Islam, interest is banned. All five of the world religions banned interest. Plato and Aristotle didn't like interest. Even Smith, father of the economy, he thought, oh, interest is a tricky thing. And why? Let's talk about why it was banned. It's not a brotherly love situation. When you actually go into the scriptures and find when it's banned for an economic point of view. Interest, utilizing interest in an economy drives up the money supply and causes inflation. So here's a little thought experiment you can run just to see how that works. This actually happened to me when I was around 11 years old, sixth grade. I read in my math book about the power of compounding interest. I'm looking at it and go, wow, I put $1,000 in a bank account. And I wait long enough, eventually all the money in the world would be in my bank account, right? So I went to my grandfather, who was a banker, and I said, look, I just figured how to get all the money in the world. I explained this. And, of course, he laughed. He said, that's clever. He goes, you know why that doesn't work? The reason that doesn't work is everybody's accounts are earning interest. He says, what you've just discovered is the failing point of interest. The fact that we're always paying interest on money causes the money supply to have to increase. Otherwise, all the money does end up in somebody's pocket. And as the money supply mm-hmm. increases, the value of the currency declines. And that's why interest was banned in the Bible, is because it destroys the value of a currency.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, of course. It just keeps metastasizing to where you have to keep borrowing more and more and more and more and more money and never service and the original debt. Well, in the very, very few minutes that we have, I mean, this is mind-blowing, of course, and I think people definitely want to have a chance to process this. What for the final 5 or 6 minutes of the show, what how is this being rolled out and presented? Is there a strategy for presenting this to the public and garnering enough interest so that it becomes an actual act of Congress?
Yeah, there is, and it's been a long drawn process, because something like this takes a long time for research to come together, put together. At this stage, my focus on this is working with a couple of DC based law firms that are advisors to Congress on drafting congressional bills. Mm-hmm. And collectively, as we sat down, we said, this is such a grand and innovative bill or act. Once it goes into law, it becomes an act. So you name it the Financial Freedom Act and hope that's what it's going to be, you know. That the drafting of it is fairly complex, because there's an awful lot of change management laws and things you need to go to. Now, that's really the job of Congress, but it ain't going to happen in Congress today. They didn't come up with this idea. It's fairly complex. So what you want is to develop the model bill. You want the gold standard. You want that bill, and then you go public with this. So sometime later in the year, if the drafting goes as quickly as we hope, then you start going into Fox News and CNN, and it starts going into the public domain. Right now, there's some talk shows that go out there. It's, you know, there's people talking online. It's catching a little traction right now. But it really needs to have all the nails in place before you really want it to go wildly viral. And so my main focus is building the cadre of talking heads that will back it up. You know, the various powers that be out there backing up, building that ground support and making sure that the bill is actually constructed properly. And then you go into Congress, and then you go before the public and you say, look, all Congress has to do is pass this bill. It's no longer, hey, there's this great idea, buy the book and, you know, hope Congress does it. Instead, you say, there's a signature ready bill. And, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you want this bill to be passed. This ought to be something that Donald Trump ought to support as equally as Pelosi does. You know, that's kind of rare.
Yeah.
And once you get it to that stage, then I think it takes off like a rocket, because you don't have the level of people against it as you do on partisan types of issues out there. This is nonpartisan. And so that's the plan. Finish up the drafting of the bill, and then pour some money and effort into making it public and see where it goes.
Yeah, you know, it's obvious. One of the areas I've been working with for years is the transpartisan domain, where you're really looking at these issues that transcend these polarizations. I mean, you can use the polarity as kind of a as an energizer to you know, bring people into conversation, but this is something that normal people on all sides will go, wow, what an idea. And it's so radical. It's such a radical change. It would and yet I think that that the public will go for it. And so I'm really glad that you've been taking all of this due care and due diligence to make sure that when it's ready to go, it's so complete that that's right. Like, well, here we go. You gotten any pushback on this from anybody?
Oh, okay. Occasionally. I think there's going to be some pushback from the health insurance industry on the medical piece. You're going to have some pushback from Wall Street, the banking industry, and banking 2.0. Although, you know, when I've met with high level executives in the banking community, they really see banking 2.0 as opening the doors for all sorts of opportunity within banking. So I don't think that's going to be the failing point. You'll find pockets of resistance, but that's where you kind of look at the tyranny of a democracy and say, look, if we're all benefiting at this level, you know, let a lobbyist try to come in on some sort of arcane angle and say, but these people would be hurt. And it's like, do we care? So I think a well-designed program will gain, you know, it's going to gain traction. I look at it as, do the Uber drivers fall in love with it when I pitch it? Yes, they do. Do the high-level bankers from Wall Street fall in love with it when I meet with them? Yeah, they do. I've talked to enough people to get a good sense that, yeah, the public's going to be behind this.
Well, thank you, Scott Smith, for sharing on the Financial Freedom Act. I think it is going to be a love story. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. You can find out more by going to my WikiPolitiki homepage and how to find out more about the Financial Freedom Act. Thank you again, Scott, and we will talk to you again next week.
You're welcome. Thank you.